new vision of happiness?
If we get a better overall view of what's happening in the economy, we'll see that we could fix a whole multitude of things, from our own personal, psychological, spiritual well-being to social relationships to environmental problems.
That's Helena Norberg-Hodge. We talked to her about the new film she co-directed, The Economics of Happiness.
There's something so passionate, so romantic, so beautiful about the train. The train almost forces us to be human with each other again.
And that's environmental writer Janice Ray. She tells us about her article in the current issue of Orion magazine, Trackback, A Love Letter to Riding the Rails. Finally, we air a clip from an archived interview with climatologist Jim Hansen. He's just come out with a new forecast of rising sea levels. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. A lot of people are talking these days about happiness studies. It's grounded in the idea that if we just think positively, we can be happy, no matter what our circumstances. Well, maybe that works in some situations, but I start to get suspicious when happiness studies experts consult with the U.S. military or multinational corporations about how to help soldiers or workers adapt happily to what are basically deeply alienating situations. The new film, The Economics of Happiness, takes a different approach. It says our spiritual satisfaction, our sense of security, our joy, derive from our deep connections with others and with our natural environment. And these connections are forged within the context of a vibrant, sustainable local economy. In other words, happiness lies in creating real circumstances in the real world that support it. The Economics of Happiness gathers voices from six continents to talk about the impact of globalization and the inspiring grassroots efforts to forge a world that serves human needs for physical, social, and spiritual sustenance. The film launched earlier in January in Seattle, Washington, and is holding screenings around the country this month and next. I caught up with Helena Norberg-Hodge via Skype to San Francisco, where she was staying for a screening. She co-wrote and co-directed the film with Stephen Gorlick and John Page. Norberg-Hodge is the founder and director of the International Society for Ecology and Culture and its predecessor, the Ladakh Project. She's the author of Ancient Futures, Learning from the Ladakh, and co-author of Bringing the Food Economy Home. This film, The Economics of Happiness, describes a world as it is now, a world that is really on the brink of total disaster. And it also holds out hope. And it begins with you in Ladakh. Tell us a little bit about your work in Ladakh and why has the film used this place as a touchstone?
Well, I ended up in Ladakh, which is also known as Little Tibet, in 1975. I went out as part of a film team. I was a linguist, and I'd been asked to come along because this part of the world was so unknown. It had been sealed off for political reasons, and it also hadn't been colonized earlier. So it was a very sort of rare and unknown situation, and they wanted me to try to pick up a bit of the language. I was going out for 6 weeks, but I became totally enchanted with this place and stayed on to do work on the language. And I learned to speak the language fluently relatively quickly and discovered that these were among the happiest, sort of most chilled out and joyous and vital people I had ever encountered. Absolutely fell in love with them. And I then decided to work on the language, but very soon also I became a sort of ambassador from the West. And it was an ambassador who was trying to explain that the West was not the paradise that they were coming to believe that it was. With a flood of influence in the form of development, tourism, imported food and media images, everything that came in made the West look very different from what it is in reality. And I discovered that these people who had the strongest sense of self-esteem and self-respect that I had encountered anywhere, suddenly the young people in particular started to feel that their culture, their language, their clothes, their food, that everything about it was inferior compared to the West. So my sort of Western, work as Western ambassador was to explain that there was no reason at all to feel inferior. In many ways, there were things that they had that we in the West would want to learn from them. And there might be some things in the West that they would find useful, like certain technologies. And so for many years, for 35 years now, I have been working out there for part of every year. And among other things, demonstrating renewable energy as an alternative to fossil fuels.
I was so struck by the joyous expressions on people's faces in the film. Tell us, what are some of the things that we can learn from the Ladakhians?
Well, you know, this is something that took me many years to learn. I was amazed at how long it took me to take away all kinds of preconceived notions that allowed me to see things the way they were. And anyway, after many years of observing both tradition and change in Ladakh, I would say that probably the most fundamental reason for this joy was the deep sense of connection and security that you gained as a child, every mother having about 10 live-in caretakers for every baby. I would also say that their ongoing relationship with animals, with plants, with the natural world around them, a sense of being deeply connected to the life around them, was part of why they themselves had such vitality, so much life in them. And so this is what has led me to promote what I call localization, the reweaving of that fabric of connection to life around us.
Now, you said you had preconceived notions. What were some of those preconceived notions, and what did it take to break through them? Can you give us an example of maybe something, a moment?
Yeah, I can remember particularly one moment when I was with some Ladakhis at harvest time outside. And the harvest time in this, Ladakh is part of Tibet culturally and topographically up on the high Tibetan plateau. It's a barren landscape, and you would think, that life is very, very hard. And in many ways, I maintained that thinking even for several years after I had spent time there. And then there was this particular aha experience when I was with the Ladakhis outside at harvest time, and these tourists came by taking pictures, and we had a bit of an exchange. And when they left, the Ladakhis said to me, "Why is it the Westerners are always in such a hurry?" And I then suddenly, after years of being in Ladakh, it occurred to me that here were the Ladakhis in their peak working season. It was really urgent to get the crop in before the snow came, and it was absolutely the peak working season. Work started early in the morning, it went till late at night, but always with this incredibly relaxed pace, singing, stopping for even celebrations and festivals went on at that time. And I suddenly realized that even during their peak working season, the Ladakhis never had the time pressures that we do in the West. And that later on led me to also realize how, in fact, even though it looked hard that you were carrying heavy loads of barley and doing quite a lot of physical work, I realized later on that, in fact, Ladakhis worked, far, far less than we do. And then even later on, I realized that that physical work was, in fact, part of the happiness. So I've ended up with a sort of list, sort of 10 steps to happiness. And certainly regular daily physical exercise, I've concluded, is one of the ingredients in staying healthy and happy.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Helena Norberg-Hodge about the new film she co-wrote and co-directed, The Economics of Happiness. There's a very striking moment in the film where you talk about a young man that you had met and you asked him what the poorest house in the village was, and he said to you, "We don't have any poor houses. We don't have any poor people here." And you saw him 10 years later, and he was telling a Westerner about how much Ladakh needed the help of the West because they were so poor.
Yeah, what had happened in the intervening years was all this stuff, including that tourists would come in and spend something like, you know, in many cases, $100 a day. Now, in the early days when they came to Ladakh, that was like Martians coming to New York and spending $100,000 a day, almost literally, because the Ladakhis didn't need money for their houses, for their food, for their clothing, for their medical care, for almost everything that they had. They didn't need money. Money was used for trade with faraway objects. It was a very small amount for luxuries, essentially. And so the comparison, you know, is roughly something like $100,000 a day. And they didn't know that we had corresponding expenses in the West. You know, they were assuming that that $100,000 was the sort of just there for luxuries, the way it is for them, the way their money was for them. So it gave a completely distorted impression about our wealth. And then, of course, in the meanwhile, as I said before, the imagery in the media, in films, and even in school books was all the time painting a picture of rural traditional life as primitive and backward, and progress, development, growth was seen as absolutely essential. So all these mental images and the money had combined to make him feel poor and backward.
Now, the film, which is called The Economics of Happiness, talks about a number of different things that globalization does. Affluence undermines community. That's something we've been just talking about. Globalization breeds insecurity. Explain this connection, how it breeds insecurity, and I wonder if you could bring in what has happened in Ladakh in the harmony between those of different religious faiths.
Yeah, thank you for asking that, because that's a very important point. Yeah, I've had a very, very rare opportunity to see these changes coming very quickly, you know, changes that in other parts of the world often took 500 years or certainly generations. But because Ladakh had been sealed off and then suddenly opened up, all these connections became more obvious. So as I said, you know, the Ladakhis were among the most deeply secure psychologically and emotionally of any people I had met. And then I saw how with the advent of this imagery and these ideas, which were all the time romanticizing an urban consumer culture, that people started feeling inadequate. And I saw how profoundly it affects young people. So that young Ladakhis were starting to feel that, oh, they need to have lighter skin and ideally blue eyes and a bigger nose to be considered beautiful and respectable. So the whole idea of beauty changed. And now there's the sale of this dangerous skin-lightening chemical called Fair and Lovely. It clearly came with the media and with the modern economy. But it also took me a while to realize that when I went back to Sweden, which is my native country, and the daughter of a friend of mine had bulimia and was almost dying because she wasn't, the food was not going through her body. It was a terrible, terrible drama and tragedy. The mother was being blamed. You know, they kept saying, you know, you paid too much attention to your weight and you've passed on this terrible illness to your daughter. No mention of the media. No mention of how the consumer culture sets up these idealized, one-dimensional images of who we should be. And when you're dark-skinned, you're, in a sense, more disadvantaged. But if we look more closely, we'll find that in America, even, you know, blonde and blue-eyed young children are suffering from this loss of self-esteem. Earlier and earlier, they're asking for plastic surgery. There's an epidemic of depression. There's an epidemic of eating disorders. So for me, I'm wanting to raise awareness about this above all, because I think that if we get a better overall view of what's happening in the economy, we'll see that we could fix a whole multitude of things, from our own personal, psychological, spiritual well-being to social relationships to environmental problems, if we focus on the economy. And if I didn't now mention about the conflict, but the conflict is that it's systemic. What the economic direction of globalizing is about supporting businesses over local businesses. So we have a whole range of subsidies and taxes and regulations that support the giants and help them destroy the small. Now, in that process, we're also subsidizing business to always choose energy and technology over human beings. So there's a direction we're moving in, where more and more jobs are being destroyed, both because of the distances and the global reach of global corporations that are always looking for the cheapest labor, but also because we're substituting human beings with technology at every turn. What I saw in Ladakh was the creation of unemployment in a very, very short period, had never existed, and suddenly had this intense competition for a few jobs. Well, this was one of the main reasons behind Buddhists and Muslims in Ladakh starting to compete and ultimately fight, and young men who became angrier and angrier and more violent. You literally had Buddhists and Muslims killing each other. At the same period, I was working in Bhutan, a small kingdom that people may have heard of, when there the same pattern was playing out. They were also opened up very late, and they had lived peacefully side by side. There it was Buddhists and Hindus. But after only a decade of this pressure of competition and unemployment, they were also killing each other. So I think we need to recognize not that this global, you know, economy today creates ethnic friction, violence, terrorism. We need to understand that this system is something that has been building up for a long time. And so even 100 years ago, much of the friction that was happening was because of the economic centralization and urbanization and the creation of unemployment. Now, that doesn't mean that predating this modern economy, that there was never conflict. There were invasions, there was violence, there were wars, for sure. But I would argue that the current system is, without a doubt, increasing violence, competition, and friction.
You know, we have been so, it has been so driven into us over and over again that the key to solving economic problems is growth. And yet, as one of the people in your film says, you know, the idea of infinite growth on a finite planet is ludicrous. It's lunacy, in fact.
Yeah, so, and I do have to say, I'm not trained as an economist. I would say, you know, I've become an analyst of the impact of this economic system, to start with on remote cultures, but then later on I've studied it internationally. And my training is actually as a linguist, and I also studied psychology. So I'm very aware of the psychological dimension of all of this. But yes, I mean, the growth, as it is measured by our governments, is truly an insanity, because it simply measures commercialization. Whenever you have to pay money for something, including your drinking water, and soon it will probably be fresh air, this is good for the economy. So this means that if pollution, for instance, oil spills and other environmental pollutants pollute water so that we have to buy it in bottles, this is really good for the economy. Even an increase in cancer is good for the economy, because it requires a whole range of commercial activities, from the radiation to the chemotherapy, every aspect. It increases economic activity and exchange of money, and that means that we view that as a positive. Even though all those economic transactions are actually a consequence of breakdown. So unless we start, you know, and it's very, very urgent now, I would say You know, we're in a situation where the weight of the global economy is like a tsunami, an economic tsunami that is striking our communities worldwide in a devastating way. So I feel, you know, we urgently need to get out the message that what is hurting your economic future, your jobs, the possibility for your children to be able to afford the rent and to have to buy a house or to even survive, is the same policies that are destroying the environment. So I'm hoping and I'm seeing that there's the beginnings of the coming together of the social and the environmental movements, linking hands for a change in the economy.
We're talking with Helena Norberg-Hodge about the economics of happiness. That's the name of the new film she co-wrote and co-directed with Stephen Gorlick and John Page. So let's talk about the nuts and bolts here. What is the prosperous economy that is one that is not based on growth? You say it's based on localism. How does it work? How does it actually satisfy our needs? And then how are we going to bring it about?
Well, the more localized economies are economies where the production and the consumption are not so far apart. Now, it doesn't have an absolute. You know, localization is necessary in contrast to the globalization that's been going on. So we need to change direction to regain a balance. So it's really about a balance. And that balance, when you study the global economy, you'll see that fundamental to that is, first of all, understanding that agriculture is the foundation of the economy, and that we have for too long allowed economists to treat farmers just as like they would factory workers producing rubber balls. These farmers have been subsidized and funded to try to create standard sized apples and potatoes, and in larger and larger and larger quantities. They've been told that their efficiency is the same as the efficiency in industrial production. This is utter madness. You know, the natural world is one of diversity, which is part of the beauty and the joy, and it relates to the uniqueness of every individual as much as the uniqueness of every plant. That means that, in fact, on the land, having diversified production so that you don't try to grow only potatoes or only apples or only chickens, means that you can, when you diversify and produce a range of things on a given plot of land, you're reducing the vulnerability, you're increasing the ecological health of the soil and generally of the ecosystem. You're providing niches for wildlife. You're providing niches for the worms and the life of the soil that is essential to healthy production. And what's so wonderful about local economies is that when farmers and consumers have a closer relationship, the pressure on the farmer is actually to diversify. It's a free market pressure that is actually doing exactly what nature needs. So the farmer can reduce their dependence on expensive and toxic inputs and end up producing more per acre of land while doing what the land and what nature needs. That's probably maybe the most important thing about understanding localization, is that it shows us a path where we can work with nature and produce more. We have been told that big-scale farming and supermarkets are necessary to feed the world. This is the biggest myth of all, because it's a lie, and it's not. The people who tell that myth don't necessarily know that it's a lie. It's been around for a long time, and it's absolutely untrue. The efficiency of large-scale monocultural production is that it produces more food per unit of people. In other words, you can do away with a lot of the farmers and use more and more energy and machinery. And for a while, that maybe looked efficient. But on a crowded planet with global warming, shortages of oil, we should immediately abandon that path and move towards diversifying and localizing. The wonderful thing about it is that it provides more jobs while reducing pollution and rebuilding a healthier economy for both the farmer and the consumer. The consumer already now in the new farmers market economy and the new consumer CSA economy actually pay less for healthy, fresh, organic food. And the farmer is earning often twice as much, three times as much as they do when they sell to the supermarkets.
In the film, The Economics of Happiness, you make the point that we have three key mechanisms, or that governments have three key mechanisms by which they have pushed the world towards globalization and how they can push it away. You say regulation, taxation, and subsidization. Give us a picture of what it would look like for a government to support localization through regulation, taxation, and subsidies.
The first step would be to demand a halt in the deregulation of the global traders. Right now, Obama is unfortunately trying to ratify a treaty with Korea, another huge step in the wrong direction. Massive. It will mean many more jobs lost. It will mean much more pollution, vast increase in CO2 emissions. But unfortunately, there are too few people who understand this. And particularly, I think people don't understand the job side of it. And so I think once people wake up to the fact that this is a disaster for them economically, as well as in terms of their own personal happiness, I think we will have a very strong movement. So next, what we'll find, and we have already been raising awareness about this for many years, is that in many cases, smaller local and even national businesses are being overregulated, while the global players are being given more freedom through deregulation. The local and national players are being overregulated. There are many instances, for instance, particularly in the food economy, where food and hygiene and public health regulations are an absolute nonsense in terms of delivering really healthy food to the consumer. Now, I'm talking a lot about food because it's so fundamental. We've got to remember it's the only thing that human beings produce that all of us need every day of the year, the only thing. And of course, we should have it fresh, ideally. So to have a system where our politicians are subsidizing the long-distance trade, which means that the food is coming to us from further and further away, which means that we are importing and exporting identical products. Live animals, water, milk, butter is being flown back and forth across the planet in larger and larger quantities. What would happen if tomorrow, around the world, everyone sat down to eat their own food from their own region? Is that multinationals wouldn't make any money, but millions of smaller farmers and smaller businesses would make money. And it turns out that this is true even in banking. It's true that with local banks who lend to the people they know in their own community are far more responsible and responsive to the needs of the community. They do not trade in toxic debt envelopes, not even knowing what they're trading. It's sort of unaccountability and the inability to see what you do in the global economy is one of the main reasons for needing localization. But so to come back to the mechanisms that we need to lobby for, another immediate change is that instead of subsidizing businesses to use more energy and technology and giving them breaks so that they pay much less per unit if they use more energy, the first step that needs to happen is that we give an incentive to businesses to employ people rather than giving them an incentive to use more energy and technology. And these are a number of subsidies and tax breaks that at the moment encourage a use of natural resources, energy, and technology. And businesses are in effect punished when they employ people with heavy employment taxes and so on.
Well, Helena Norberg-Hodge, thanks so much. It is a very powerful film, a beautiful film that you've produced, The Economics of Happiness. We'll link to it on the Writer's Voice website. And thanks so much for talking with us here.
Thank you.
Helena Norberg-Hodge has written for The Ecologist, Resurgence, and Yes Magazine. She received the Right Livelihood Award for her work in Ladakh. You can watch a trailer for The Economics of Happiness at writersvoice.net. Next up, we talk with Janice Ray about riding the rails. Stay tuned.
Can you call on your imagination as if telling a myth to a child? Put in the fantastical, wonderful, magical, and the romantic, the brave and the wild. Once upon a time there was a power so great that no one could know its name. People tried to claim it and rule with it, always such arrogance and it in shame. Thousands of years in a moment, hundreds of cultures would come and go, each generation with a glorious calling, even when they were too busy to know. And then one day, after 2 millennia, which after all was a small part of time, hundreds of souls found their way out of nowhere to be on Earth at the threat of decline.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Poet and environmental writer Janice Ray used to fly all around the country to talk about our need to preserve our environment. Then she got to thinking, wait a second, here I am talking about the environment and causing thousands of tons of carbon dioxide to be spewed out while I'm flying doing it. That didn't sit well. So 3 years ago, Ray decided to start taking the train. She found out that she got a lot more out of it than saving energy. She found poetry on trains through the people she met, the conversations she had, and the time to savor the passing view. Janice Ray writes about that in the current issue of Orion magazine. Her article is Track Back, a Love Letter to Riding the Rails. Janice Ray, welcome to Writer's Voice. Now, you are from the South. I can tell both from your accent and also from your piece, a beautiful piece that's coming out in Orion magazine, A Love Letter to Riding the Rails. Where are you talking to us from?
I live in southern Georgia near Reidsville. I'm very close to the Ottumwa River. I'm in a little delta between the Ohoopee and the Ottumwa Rivers. It's about an hour and a half inland from Savannah.
And you are, unlike much of rural America, as you point out in your piece for Orion, you're actually pretty well served by the rails. Is that right?
I am. Our nearest rail station is in Jessup, Georgia. It's a tiny stop. The station was burned out, and it's just this dilapidated hull of a building. But the two trains pass daily. One is going south to Miami. This is the Silver Meteor. And then so you can get on the train in the morning and be in Miami by late afternoon, evening. Or you can embark on a journey in the late evening at Jessup and be in Washington, D.C. early the next morning or at New York Penn Station by about 11 o'clock.
That's pretty good.
It's very good. I just heard online from a woman who lives in Boise, and she said that her nearest train station was 300 miles in Salt Lake City. And so train riding in the West, she called a hobby, as opposed to it being a real alternative here to plane and single-passenger car travel.
Now, how did you get into riding the rails? Tell us a little bit about yourself. I know you're an environmental writer. What happened that sent you to the train to travel around the country?
I'm a nature writer, Francesca. I'm very concerned in this lifetime about how we live on the planet. There's no greater goal before us in the 21st century than us figuring out how we're going to live on the planet without destroying it. 25 years ago, when I was, you know, first realizing that I loved to ride, I wanted to ride, and I also loved nature, and that I needed to put those two together, I was very happy writing about wildness, about hiking in the backcountry of Montana. And as the years have passed, I've come to realize that in our personal daily lives, we have to figure out for ourselves what we're going to do. I found myself as a rider jetting across the country here and there doing talks on sustainability, lots of talks, and it ceased to make sense to me. So the only one compromise I could think of was to start going by rail. I remember, Francesca, when Gary Nabhan was the first person that I knew of who really talked about eating locally, being a locavore, although that term came later. Many years ago, he was at a conference. It was Orion's conference called Fire and Grid, and he had brought a lot of his own food. He said, I'm trying to eat 80% of my diet from, I think, 100-mile, 200-mile radius. First I'd ever heard of it. And the reason he gave was he was trying to weave his life back together. And I think that is the essential reason that I started looking at the train as a way to travel. It just ceased to make sense that I was, you know, here for an evening and then back on a plane and there for the next evening and back on a plane. So it was a way that I chose to slow down.
And then you started getting very concerned about the climate crisis, and that sharpened your resolve.
Well, I guess I just misspoke, because it was actually the climate crisis that it's equal in my mind. Me wanting to have a sane, more rational life, but part of that is all of that was driven by my absolute worry, abject worry over the state of the atmosphere and all of our responsibility to do something about it. I talk a lot about this and think a lot about it, that we need to change policy in this country, and I agree with that. But I also think that personal actions have to change. And, you know, I still use plenty of fossil fuels. We drive a car. I am no saint here. I'm also a sinner. But I believe that there's a continuum, and the continuum is, you know, from extreme luxuriant wastefulness to rational sustainability. And I'm on that continuum. I want every day to be moving in that direction. I'm connected to the grid, for example.
Mm-hmm.
We desperately want solar panels, and we're working, you know, to save money now to switch our house over to a different form of power. So I try to remove didacticism, if I can, from my work.
And to live it. You know, what you highlight in your article, A Love Letter to Riding the Rails, among other things, I mean, you highlight the positive aspects of this, the tremendous camaraderie, the way one can really meet very interesting people, which we'll talk about a little bit later. But you also highlight that, you know, there has to be some structural changes. I mean, I've spent a fair amount of time in Europe. I was doing the research for a book there and went back, you know, year after year until I also decided to quit using plane travel. And I rode the rails everywhere there, and it's so easy to do that. And it's quicker than taking a plane.
People find that hard to believe, that by the time I drive to Jacksonville, which is a 3.5-hour trip, or drive to Savannah, which is an hour and a half, then wait, honestly, I can be in Washington quicker than I can fly there.
So tell us a little bit about the train, the romance of the train for you.
I think that's what a lot of people don't understand about the train. Riding the train, to many, is retrogressive, but there is something so passionate, so romantic, so beautiful about the train. Cosmic entrapment was what I heard a young student was riding to Chicago, and I happened to be sitting behind him, and I heard him use the term cosmic entrapment. The train almost forces us to be human with each other again, that, you know, you're there in a space with somebody. You're spending the night often with somebody, you know, either... If you're in a sleeper car, you're not so much interacting with people, but if you're in a coach seat and it's an overnight somewhere, you're there with people, and it's so many wonderful... One piece that got cut out of the story is my son Silas was riding home to Georgia from Amherst, and about 2 weeks afterwards, I got a letter from a friend who happens to live in Washington, and he said, I didn't know it at the time, but I was the seatmate with your son. He said, he was a nice young man. He sat beside me. We talked. He stayed in the club car a lot playing chess. And when he got off, I saw you on the platform waiting for him. And then I put it all together. And it's that kind of serendipity. It still happens in airports, but it happens more often on trains.
You know, you're inspiring me to share with you and with our listeners a train trip that I took when my son was 13. We did one of those great Amtrak deals where you pay a certain amount and you can ride the train, stop anywhere you want within a 6-week period. So you can get on and off and on and off. And we bought three sections of the country. So we went all the way out. We took the northern route, went all the way out to Seattle. And this was 1993. On the way back, I don't know if you remember this, but 1993 was a year of the great Midwestern floods. Mm-hmm. And on the way back, the train was almost the only thing above water, except for the roofs of the houses that were flooded around us. And it was pelted by, you know, rain day and night, the 4 days back. But there happened to be a troop of young high school band students, all girls, and my son was just in heaven. He spent the whole time hanging out with the girls while I was able to, you know, sit in the back and read to my heart's delight. And, you know, live in this enclosed space, feeling very safe while, you know, the world was practically drowning around us. It was a remarkable experience.
I love that. I love that. I have the same feeling of safety. I know trains wreck, but I just have that same feeling on a train.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit more about some of your travels, some of the people that you met on the train that you talk about in this article, Janice Ray. This article, A Love Letter to Riding the Rails, it's going to be appearing in the February or January issue of Orion.
It's in the January issue. It's just come out, January, February issue of Orion magazine. One of the characters that I write about was a young man who got on the train somewhere in Ohio. And I remember he was just sleeping, and then the train stopped at Cleveland and let a young woman on, and he just came alive. He was so happy to be sitting beside this young woman, And he started joking. Let's see if I can find it here in the piece. A wind turbine spins behind the station in Cleveland. A hefty 28-year-old from Detroit has been sleeping, snoring, until a woman about 20 gets on and sits beside the guy, who suddenly comes to life, and he's funny. He went to college in Alabama, couldn't study for the girls, said he prayed to God, but he couldn't concentrate. He'd need an all-boys school. I told my professor, he says, talk to me like I'm two. He was in jail once for a month, but he'll never do that again. If he got in trouble now, he'd go to Africa. He wants to go to Africa. Over email, he chats with the king of the Zulus. And then just one more little paragraph. There's a retired couple with a third suitcase full of food sightseeing across the continent on some kind of path. Amish families with healthy children in crisp white hoods unwrap homemade sandwiches.
You also have a passage about a Chaucer reciting conductor. Read that one. That was wonderful, too.
That was wonderful. I was headed with friends, just a day trip, from Jessup, where we caught the train, down to DeLand. One of my favorite thinkers and poets, Wendell Berry, was speaking in DeLand, and we wanted to hear him. And the conductor happened to be, he was coming through checking tickets, and he stopped at the man in front of me, and the man had misplaced his ticket stub. And so the conductor recited the passage from the rule book that says, you know, as long as you're on the train, you better keep your ticket stub. And I said something like, wow, you have that recited. And he said, well, he replied something. And then my friend across the aisle said, but I bet you can't recite Chaucer. And the man pulled himself up, you know, tucked in his shirt, and he starts reciting the beginning lines of Canterbury Tales. Just amazing moment.
Your jaw must have dropped at that one.
That's just amazing.
That's great. But it's not so easy for a lot of people to take the trains. I mean, what's been happening? What is happening to passenger trains in America? I mean, we hear about high-speed trains being in the works, but what's really going on here?
I think there's been a concerted effort, Francesca, really to push the rails out. I mean, and even now you hear all this talk about, oh, we've nationalized rail service, and it's almost like, you know, Amtrak is Medicaid, or Amtrak is disability payments. And I believe it's because there are corporations that make more money selling cars, selling gasoline, building roads, selling the equipment to build roads, and it's really a matter of corporate control of our lives again.
Mm-hmm.
And in that scenario, there's very little care given to a long-term outlook about how we're going to protect the things that are precious to us. It's not just the atmosphere that we're losing. We're losing free time. We're losing our rivers, our small farms, our farmers, our prairies.
And if I may read what you've written back, I mean, this was something that really struck me. May I?
Yes.
The global climate disruption, that's what we humans are doing. We're throwing away the things most beautiful and meaningful to us, things we thought immutable, predictable seasons, weather we can trust, polar bears, coastlines, entire islands, permafrost, glaciers. Imagine throwing away the glaciers, you write. That really brings it home.
Mm-hmm. And yet we are.
So how do you handle this? I mean, you've taken your own step was to eschew plane travel, to take the trains. You discovered poetry happens on trains, as you write, Janice Ray, in your article for Orion. And yet you also carry with you this burden of sorrow. So how does that mix within you, the sorrow and the joy?
But Francesca, if I continued in the way that I was living, I would be so angry and so much more sorrowful. And at least I know that I'm doing everything right now that I can do. I'm doing my part in stopping it. I was given a talk to student energy activists at the University of Georgia not long ago, and I was just telling them about how we live. You know, there's very little that's electric in our house. You know, we don't have a blow dryer. We don't have, everything is manual. You know, we sweep the floors. We mop by hand. And to have all those gadgets in my house with me staring at them daily would make me so furious at myself and at the world that we're replacing what's important, what's meaningful, what's lasting, what gives us life for convenience, ease, greed. And so in that regard, I don't feel sorrowful riding the train. I feel joyful riding it. I feel like it's one of the few little things that I can do.
And have a great time doing it.
A great time doing it.
Janice Ray, your article is a love letter to riding the rails, and it is in the January-February issue of Orion. Thanks so much for talking with us here, and be sure and let us know if you've got other things in the pipeline.
Thank you so very much, Francesca, and I hope to see you on some wonderful
train ride.
Train one day.
Oh, yeah, that would be great. Janice Ray's article is Trackback, a love letter to riding the rails. You can read it at writersvoice.net. Ray is the author of 3 books of nonfiction, as well as a collection of poetry, A House of Branches. She rides the rails from southern Georgia. World-renowned climate scientist Jim Hansen was the first to warn the U.S. Congress about the dangers of global warming. And that was back in the 1980s. He's just released a new paper with co-author Makiko Sato, warning the world that we are at a climate tipping point. Once we cross it, we risk multi-meter sea level rise this century. The paper they wrote is Paleoclimate Implications for Human-Made Climate Change. The authors warn we could return to the temperatures of the early Pliocene age, when sea level was about 25 meters or 82 feet higher than today. I spoke with Jim Hansen early last year. Here's a clip from that interview where he talks about sea level rise and the dangerous climate feedback loops that threaten to bring it about. The target for global warming that was set at Copenhagen was a rise of 2 degrees Celsius. What do you think of that target?
Well, we know that that's a disaster scenario. So far, we've had a rise in temperature of 0.8 degrees Celsius. And we already see that the ice sheets on Greenland and Antarctica are not going to be stable on the long run. The rate at which Greenland is losing ice accelerated from 150 cubic kilometers several years ago to 300 cubic kilometers per year now, and likewise Antarctic rate of ice loss has accelerated. 2-degree warming would mean that those ice sheets are unstable and we will get sea level rise of several meters, which would have disastrous consequences. And we would also lose all the mountain glaciers around the world, which provide fresh water for actually billions of people from the rivers that originate in the mountains. And the expansion of the subtropics, which we can already see is affecting the southwest United States and causing the lakes to run dry and forest fires to increase, the Arctic sea ice would all be gone with the effects that would have on wildlife there and indigenous peoples. So what we've learned in the last few years is that to stabilize climate at a level that allows the species that we now have on the planet to continue to exist is going to require that we stabilize carbon dioxide at a level of no more than 350 parts per million.
One thing that seems striking to me is that there's an awful lot of talk about how climate change is going to affect those people over there. It'll affect Africa. It will affect Bangladesh. And of course, those are terrible things, but there seems to be an assumption that it's not going to be affecting us here at home. What kind of sea level rise are we likely to see here in the U.S., especially on the East Coast?
That depends on what time scale we refer to, but that's why I'm concerned particularly about my children and grandchildren, because we can see very well what is going to happen as warming continues and as the ice sheets become more and more unstable. Because what happens is, as the rate of discharge of these icebergs to the ocean increases, we will reach a level at which they begin to cool the North Atlantic and the Southern Ocean around Antarctica. And as the low latitudes continue to get warmer, this increased temperature gradient from the low latitudes to the high latitudes will drive stronger frontal or cyclonic storms, which in extreme cases generate winds comparable to that in hurricanes. When you combine these stronger storms with the rising sea level, we're going to get disasters at coastal cities all along the United States coast and other coastlines, which, because of the populations, I mean, we had a disaster at New Orleans, but that's a relatively small city. Once we start to have storm tides and increasing sea level on large cities, we're going to have social and economic disasters associated with that, which will make New Orleans look like a small thing in comparison.
Hansen says that while the Earth has gone through climate change before, human-caused climate change is happening at a much faster rate, about 10,000 times faster.
It's certainly true. There have been huge climate changes in the Earth's history. If we go back 50 million years, there was no ice on the planet. It was much warmer. Sea level was 75 meters, about almost 250 feet higher than it is now. And, of course, that if you got to that situation, it would be pretty stable. But to get there from here would, of course, flood billions of people out of their homes. And we have lived in a climate, the Holocene, the last 10,000 years, in which the climate has been relatively stable with sea level at the level it is now. And, yeah, the rate at which we are changing carbon dioxide is about 10,000 times faster than the natural rates of increase or decrease that gave rise to these very large but slow changes of the climate during the Earth's history. And, of course, if we civilization developed with the climate that we've had during the last 10,000 years, and unless we want enormous disruptions to civilization, we need to keep the climate roughly within that range that has existed during the last 10,000 years.
Climate scientist Jim Hansen. We spoke to him in February of 2010 about his book Storms of My Grandchildren. You can hear the whole interview at writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net for more about today's shows. You'll find links to more information, web-only features, and you can sign up for our podcast and get connected on Twitter and Facebook. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.